personal private collection of panic. I need to write. It keeps me focused for long enough to complete thoughts, to let each train of thought run to its conclusion and let a new one begin. It keeps me thinking. I'm afraid that if I stop writing, I'll stop thinking and start feeling. I can't concentrate when I'm feeling. I try to put the feelings into thoughts or words, but it always seems to come out in disjointed, sweeping statements. Adolescent jargon peppered with random selections from a fairly gaudy vocabulary. A Fredericks of Hollywood vocabulary. I wish that I could leave myself alone. I wish that I could finally feel that I punished myself enough, that I deserved time off for all my bad behavior. Let myself off the hook, drag myself off the rack where I am both torturer and torturee. I confide in everyone. I have no restricted private self reserved specifically for certain trusted special people. I trust and mistrust anyone. I have traveled a full circle, but this time, on returning to zero again, I am able to act out the mistake more adeptly. I am on my way to becoming a very skilled loser, a specialist, a loser to end all losers, a flair for failing. I do it with style and finesse. I am on physical and mental reserves, carefully selecting and gathering all the ingredients for my recipe for ruin. Homemade hysteria, fresh from my mind and ready to serve, torment to go. I must never again involve myself in a situation that makes me feel this sordid. Hand over hand on the way to the top, so afraid to fall back to the beginning, wishing it were more of a drop. Happiness beckons you, in the guise of money and fame. It can all be yours someday, at the drop of a name. To be one of the familiar faces, calling the shots on a first-name basis, that's your desire. But you've got to get a lot higher, on the ladder, then nothing will matter. You'll be all set, on top of the world. That's where you want to get. A household word, like Ajax or Abby Lane, a reputation to live up to, an explosion to sustain. Watch him. There he goes, folks, higher and higher, hoping to get out of the anonymous frying pan and into the Hollywood fire. The compromise I made was not an easy thing to do. It was either you or me, and I chose you. Although far from a joker, you spoke in wry, wry riddles. I could have given you so much, but you wanted so little. I thought you might supply some tenderness I lacked. But out of all the things I offered, you took my breath away, and now I want it back. I never had what I wanted, because I would never want what I had. I thought you were different, prettier than most, and twice as bad. Uncompromising and caustic, sort of short and sometimes sweet. I tried to read between your lines as you would so rarely speak. But I gave you far more credit than you were actually due. You see, I thought I was only seeing half the man, but that was all there was to you. You took my breath away. Took my breath away. You took my breath away, and now I want it back. Your once upon a time is up. Prince Charming's been abducted. Tinkerbell's on angel dust, the Matterhorn erupted. Your once upon a time is up, Tammy's talking dirty, Dumbo has a PhD, Leia's 2x30. I am closer to who I want to be when I am alone lately. With people, I hear my voice and I just wonder who or what I'm doing all this for. Spreading myself out in front of people. Devaluing my ostensible worth by being so readily available to almost any random pedestrian who wanders into the crosswalk of my focus. If someone is within an earshot, I shoot off at the mouth. This drug has placed me in the eye of the hurricane. Or is it a tornado? Whatever it is, it's a whole lot of weather, placing everything valuable in jeopardy. If I could only get a fixed idea myself, I wouldn't have to constantly look to other people, trying to outguess them, to convince them of my idea of myself. Hoping that if they believe that's who I am, then maybe I'll be able to believe it too. But when they do believe it, when they seem convinced that I am who I'm seeming to be, and they even approve, I inevitably feel that I've fooled them, that they must be pretty goddamn gullible to fall for my routines. My panic is rising again, my sense of isolation and worthlessness. And no other sense is worth mentioning, apparently. It's not nice being inside my head. It's a nice place to visit, but I don't want to live in here. It's too crowded. Too many traps and pitfalls. I'm tired of it. The same old person day in and day out. I'd like to try something else. I tried to neaten my mind, file everything away into tidy little thoughts, but it only got more and more cluttered. My mind has a mind of its own. I try to define my limits by seeing just how far I can go, and I find that I passed them weeks ago, and I've got to find my way back. Stop playing the part of the glib martyr. You're just trying to make cyanide out of 7-Up. I talk about myself in the third person as if I were talking about a child of mine, or a new television series. I talk about myself behind my back. I talk about my private life and self like they were just common gossip. I make and sell myself cheap. I serialize myself. I am the Mad Magazine version of Psychology Today. I waste myself. Here's what he said. People adapt to you. Don't worry, you can't alter what they think of you to any great degree. And by the same token, what they think of you can't alter you. You sit patiently, awaiting that dreaded yet hoped-for disapproval. You're afraid you seem foolish or pretentious. You pounce on everything you say with a pair of tweezers and pluck it about until you can't remember exactly what it is you said, what context it was in, if you even said it and if anyone heard you at all, and how much their opinion means to you. Are their mental credentials so impressive that you have to put yourself behind their eyes, find yourself loathsome and/or boring, and then make it matter? Why am I in such a hurry to find out what people think of me? I even have gone to the trouble of playing myself broadly in order to hurry up their decision. I give them one of many varieties of brief or not-so-brief summaries from which they can draw a conclusion. It depends on how much time and energy I've got, and then I give away portions of myself according to that. I mustn't allow myself to get sucked into thinking that it's romantic to be neurotic. That being neurotic means one has to be complicated and somewhat intellectual, deep, proud of the fact that you can sink to the depths of despair. A neurotic, complicated, somewhat intellectual, deep gal who's also wacky, zany, and madcap. A must at a wake. I must be who I am, and people adjust to it. Don't try to rush or influence the decision. Do not let what you think they think of you make you stop and question everything you are. Surely between the various yous, you can find that you not only have enough going for you to keep you going, but to take you far, maybe even to Alderaan and back. Who are you doing all this bullshit for? Certainly not yourself. If you were the only one around to be yourself for, you'd stop for the lack of interest. You know all the shit you tell people. You know it, you've lived it, you're living it, etc. So what's the point of telling any and everybody else? Ingratiating yourself to them by being so available. Admitting and confessing and confiding all those things that sound secret and special and spontaneous, when it's really just the same old ploy. Seduction. I would resent if I were on the outside looking in. Someone telling me things I didn't ask to hear. Telling me things I don't want to hear. Too much too soon. And I don't know what she wants in return. Am I supposed to nod and smile, look interested, or does she expect me to exchange stories? Does she expect me to tell her about my childhood? My parents? Guilt? Anxiety? Fears? Sexuality? Because if she does, she's got another thing coming. I should let people I meet do the work of piecing me together until they can complete or mostly complete the puzzle. And when they've finished, they can look at the picture that they've managed to piece together and decide whether they like it or not, on their own time. Let them discover you. You're my thought collector, part-time love rejector, dragging round and round and round in my dreams. And you make me smile, decorate my meanwhile, driving me to extremes. Can you hear me, my sweet chauffeur? Driving me to extremes. Something really incredible happened to me. Something that should have happened a long time ago, but Jesus, I'm just grateful it happened. I mean, it's changed everything. You probably think, oh, she's falling in love, or she's found God, or the IRA, or whatever. But it's nothing like that. Although, in a way, it's like all those things because it's kind of a revolutionary, deep, emotional, religious experience. And yet, not like that at all. I suppose I should just tell you exactly what happened and let it speak for itself. I was sitting by myself the other night doing the usual things one does when spending time alone with yourselves. You know, making mountains out of molehills, hiking up to the top of the mountains, having a hostess Twinkie and then throwing myself off the mountain. Stuff like that. Anyway, I'd done this, oh, 4, maybe 5, we'll call it an even 19 times. I was just about ready to start construction on my 20th molehill when I suddenly thought I heard someone playing a polka outside my window. I later discovered that it was a recording of Ray Conniff jamming live at the Troubadour with Led Zeppelin. It was early Ray Conniff, before he got really commercial. When he was still really mellow and innovative and, well, when his music got inside you. You know what I mean? You remember the days when everyone would rush home from school, grab some Fritos and Ripple wine, put on their favorite Ray Conniff album and just unwind? And finding out when his new album was coming out and rushing down to Discount Records, hoping that they've not sold out? I know one guy who actually saw a Ray Conniff concert, before he stopped giving them because the girls would scream so loud that you couldn't hear his music. But this guy was close and could hear pretty well, and he was just, well, completely blown away. I mean, he said it was so fucking moving, you know? He said that Ray Conniff, and I do not make this up, he said that Ray Conniff was the most real person, the most together person he'd ever seen. And this guy's been around and met them all, yes, including Mantovani. And yet, Ray Conniff was the one person whose mere presence and even mirror music moved him profoundly. Anyway, all this has nothing to do with my experience, really, except I think it is somehow ironic that I should be sitting there and suddenly hear this incredible music that had meant so much to me. So I stopped work on my molehill and went to the window to see where this music was coming from. Suddenly, I noticed a light in the distance that seemed to be coming towards me. As it grew closer, I could see the light was coming from a fire. I look back on this and find it really strange and sort of eerie, but at the time I thought nothing of it. It was almost 5 feet in front of me when I realized I was looking at a man sitting on a flaming pie. He smiled serenely at me, or maybe he coughed violently, but whatever it was mystical. Almost embarrassingly mystical, if you know what I mean. The man must have noticed me blushing because he offered me a rainbow trout and enough money to finish my payments on my new Dynagym. My eyes filled with tears, and he leaned over and wiped my eyes with the trout and then said, "You needn't ever make mountains out of molehills again. You have misjudged yourself. You are not who you think you are. You have been examining yourself from the wrong end of the telescope, one might say. You can set up housekeeping on one side of the looking glass or the other. The side that makes big things small or small things big. I like to hang out on the big things small side. You meet a better class of people there. But of late, you haven't been able to see yourself clearly. You see, my dear, you are not Carrie Fisher at all. They just told you that to test you. Well now, my dear, the test is over, and I'm pleased to say you pass with a C-. Now you can graduate to your true identity. You see, my dear, you are really Mr. Ed, and you have been all along. You can now live out your life as who you were intended to be. Farewell." As I watched him disappear on his flaming pie, I suddenly noticed the rainbow trout smiling at me from the windowsill where the mystical pie man had left him. I started to ask if I could get him something, a drink, or some bait, when he suddenly let out a shrill laugh, as only a fish can do. I politely asked him what was so funny, and he said, "You. So you're Mr. Ed, old horse-faced with the dumb jokes. No wonder you got canceled." Then he laughed again and continued laughing until he fell off the windowsill and into the street below. He lay in the street the entire night screaming with laughter, and then suddenly, the laughing stopped. I don't know what happened to him. Although recently someone was talking about the sequel Don Knotts was doing to The Incredible Mr. Limpet. The Incredible Mr. Limpet 2. And they were describing the fish that had the lead opposite Knotts. And it could only have been my rainbow trout. Mystical, huh? There are plenty of fish in the sea, and you sure look like a fish to me. As soft as a crayfish with a mouth that opens and closes, and like a fish you don't say pretty things, and you don't send no roses. There are plenty of fish in plenty of seas, and like a fish, you don't bring shiny diamonds and fall to your knees. If you'd never gotten close, I wouldn't have noticed when you were far away. But you filled up my nights and then emptied my days. There are girls who can be helped, and there are girls who can be had. But you helped me, and then had me. And now, fish, I need help again. I need help real bad. But like the fisherman said, there are plenty of fish in the sea. And maybe someday, some sweet salmon will come and swim away with me. When we talk, it's not merely idle chatter. We discuss things that really don't matter. We talk of love and God and pain. To life's never-ending song, we add yet one more refrain. And as the pace gets more and more frantic, the words get more and more pedantic. We leave no sophistry unturned. As our rhetoric becomes more intense, using our very large vocabularies to disguise our very common sense. The words get longer and the plot gets thinner, another discourse to discuss at dinner. There is no feeling we can't analyze, seizing each chance to intellectualize, talking in the past and present tense. We're making a lot more noise and a lot less sense. She, I love you. He, what? She, nothing, never mind. Pause. He, is something the matter? I mean, you seem sort of uncomfortable. She. Me? No, I'm fine. I feel like a water lily floating on a Chinese lagoon. He. You what? She. I said I feel like a... Oh, never mind. Everything's fine. I'm fine. He. You sure? She. Yes, I'm just a little wired, that's all. He. You want anything? She. Anything. He looks at her for a moment, then stares off into space, nodding. She laughs. He. What? She. Hmm? He. You looked like you were about to say something. She. Did I? I always look like that, I guess. It's kind of a twitch. He looks off into space. Sheila and Hugh. Resting in arms, testing your charms. Repeating a ritualized, I love you. Sharing a fight or a kiss in the night. Shrugging when friends ask, what's new? After the wedding, her hips started spreading. His hairline began to recede. They remain together out of habit now, and not out of any great need. He'll show up from work, showing signs of strain, while her day was spent cleaning, letting the soap operas wash her brain. He reads the evening paper. She calls him in to eat. They share their meal silently. She's bored, he's just beat. Then they climb the stairs, multiplying the monotony. With each step they take, the hours spent sleeping, they find more satisfying than those spent awake. He removes his work clothes. She puts on her curlers and cream, hoping the sheets will protect them from the demon of daily routine. Then he clicks off the lamp, and the darkness holds no noise, for in the dark you can be anyone. Housewives will be girls, and businessmen, boys. I love you, Sheila. I love you, Hugh. But she's deciding on dishes, and his thoughts are all askew. And the sheets supply refuge for this perpetual pair, neither really knowing any more why the other one is there. I act like someone in a bomb shelter trying to raise everyone's spirits. He's far from a fool, nowhere near. I'm quite near. I can feel the fool that's so far away from him breathing down my neck. I would like to not be able to hear myself think. I constantly hear my mind chattering and jabbering away up there all by itself. I wish it would give me a fucking break. Right, don't think, right. You're not thinking properly, Ms. Fisher. I suggest you write. If anyone reads this when I have passed to the big bad beyond, I shall be posthumously embarrassed. I shall spend my entire afterlife blushing. I'm scared. Scared that I'll let Harrison hurt me. That I'll change plain old leaving into abandonment again. It's no mean feat. Hurting might be familiar, but it certainly isn't fun. It's a bit pathetic to set yourself up to be humiliated or passed over or whatever, and then at the last minute deciding it really wasn't what you had in mind. Perhaps you could show me something in rayon. None of us have been really given the opportunity to explore the possibility that, given our own situation, we might not choose to see one another. We're thrown together and we make the best of one another, if for no other reason than convenience. Would we still seek out each other's company in real life, when we regained our temporarily suspended perspective? I don't think we could honestly say at this point. We could very easily be deceived by the sheer convenience of one another and the seeming absence of options. At this point, your main objective would be to find someone, anyone, as long as they were close, willing, and this side of the grave. It's not difficult to live up to those qualifications. Something handy, immediate, and as human as possible. We aren't really in the position to be choosy. The real test is being in a situation where it's not just convenient, where there are a substantial number of alternatives to the more than likely possibility of coming down with a case of 24-hour loneliness. Anyway, as George's wife Marcia says, we're gold in the same place, referring to the theory that we look for people that are gold in the place where we're shit and shit in the places where we're gold. So instead of picking up where you leave off, we pick up and leave off in practically the same place, that place being somewhere between high school and Gilligan's Island. I do not want to take part in my life. It can just go on without me. I'm not giving it any help. I don't want to see it. I don't want to talk to it. I don't want it anywhere near me. It takes too much energy. I refuse to be a part of it. If you have a life, even if you get used to it ruining your sleep, spoiling your fun, requiring your somewhat undivided attention, what overwhelming relief one must feel when it finally skips town. I don't like having to keep the spinning plates spinning on top of all their various and sun-dried poles. From now on, they can fall off the poles and break for all I care. I censor myself, and where the fuck does it get you? Gussying up your thoughts and putting them to paper. A woman's place is in the home, seated by the telephone. Men sow their wild oats, and women are sown. Here I am again, making the same mistake. Instead of learning my lesson, I just establish a new record to break. What's the riddle? Me talking so much and saying so little. She. One of us is boring. He. Why do you say that? She. Because, well, we're just sitting here not talking. He. What's wrong with that? She. Well, I don't know. Probably nothing. It's just that we don't need each other for it. He. For what? She. Being quiet. The Itsy Bitsy spidered his way up my water spout. He little Jack Hornered his way into my corner, and now I can't get him out. He ate all my porridge, sat in my chair, slept in my bed, washed himself into my hair. Hey, all you king's horses, whether you're horses' asses or men, could you pretty please piece my heart back together again? Love has made me what I am today, but as to what that is, I really couldn't say. One thing's for certain, I am quite alone. 'Cause there are none so quiet as those who will not phone. And there is no one as far past caring as he who just don't care. I've washed that man right into my hair. He's sat in my chair and slept in my bed. He's eaten all my porridge and climbed inside my head. Maybe no man is an island, but some might as well be. The type whose bats always seem to get in your belfry. What am I getting myself into that I don't want out of? I can't remember beginning. I can't conceive of ending. That I am afraid of. That I need. That I find unlike anything I could ever have imagined or anticipated that I can't do without. That I don't know what to do with the cliché. And what if I said I loved you? What then? To justify some delinquent desire with the confessions of some emotion? You'd know where you stood. Right on my feet. It needn't be anything. But it's the possibility that leaves us delirious with dull discussions. This is fairly new. Incurable optimist that I am bravely inclined to think it's temporary. The $100 question. What do we mean to one another? Afraid the answers won't support each other. And all this talking around the issue, but what is it? Let's define our relationship, you bastard. I spend my entire epic existence vacillating between extremes, and I think possibly this might be changing. But no. What the fuck happened to the in-between? Midway between passive and panicked? I seem to become involved in situations that only allow for tension. I'm beginning to think relaxation is a rumor, a vicious rumor started by a sadistic... We could come to a full stop now if you think that would help. Because like any other B-movie heroine, I can't go on like this. Can you understand? I don't want to hurt you any more than I want you to hurt me. It's now a question of surviving each other's company instead of enjoying it. Trying relentlessly to make you love me, but I don't want the love. I quite prefer the quest for it, the challenge. I am always disappointed with someone who loves me. How perfect can he be if he can't see through me? I can just get so close, till I begin to suffocate. I must go back to the surface to breathe. I catch my breath, I manage to breathe, offhandedly supplying distance, while I seemingly never leave. To compensate for my lack of honesty, I entertained with distorted truths, my inadequacies and obsessions. If a personality can be promiscuous, mine would be quite loose. Try as I might, I can give to you no more than I give the next person, or the last. I set the stage by establishing positions. You are the audience, I, the cast. I try to be somewhat exclusive. Somehow I never quite succeed. We'll keep in touch. But enough is too much. I'll need new disinterest on which to feed. Of course I'm playing a losing hand. A hand on which I invite you to tread. If only I could love someone, but I've chosen to love anyone instead. Who am I doing it for? I asked him. It was a fairly rhetorical question, and the only reply it warranted was a shrug, which he supplied. I sat on the floor engrossed in the empty space before me. He lay stretched out on the couch looking sturdy and sure. Maybe no man is an island, but some sure look like one. All safe and dry and looming on your horizon. But the current was against me, and who was I kidding? His island was already inhabited, and here I was, a teenage trespasser. All I had to do was make the most of being adrift. He yawned. I looked at him with a minimal amount of expectancy. He looked over at me, and I had to look away. I didn't want him to see that I belonged to him. It was bad enough that I knew it. I didn't want him to know it, too. I kept it from myself for almost 2 months now, calling it everything from physical to a big mistake. Not that it wasn't those things, it was, but when I gave myself to him, Merry Christmas, baby, I gave myself for a while, not just for a good time. But whatever kind of time it was running out. He was leaving Sunday, so there we were, Tuesday night, sitting in the lurch that he would leave me in. Nothing personal, of course. He finished filming and had to go home to his wife and kids. Aye, there's the rub. That's when Cinderella's pre-shattered post-ball shoe was scheduled to drop. With him, love was easier done than said. Instead of taking you to heart, he would take you to bed. And you take what he has to offer lying down, you're getting more involved while he's still getting around. It's all a matter of touch and go, 'cause he's one for all and all for show. But after all was said and almost done, I was playing for keeps, and he was playing for fun. I call people sometimes hoping not only that they'll verify the fact that I'm alive, but that they'll also, however indirectly, convince me that being alive is an appropriate state for me to be in. Because sometimes I don't think it's such a bright idea. Is it worth the trouble it takes trying to live life so that someday you get something worthwhile out of it, instead of it almost always taking worthwhile things out of you? I wish I could go away somewhere, but the only problem with that is that I'd have to go too. Hey, check-coated guy, blow your smoke into my favorite eye. Steal your arm around me till you've finally found me, all under a moonlit sky, oh my, all under a moonlit sky. Moving side to side on a dampening lawn, my head falling to his shoulder, he's stifling a deep yawn. The party fast receding, leaving the dancers with the night. Someone runs some water. Someone turns out a light. Half woman and half bar stool. The room spinning round from rounds of drink. She sits hunched over her wine glass, returning any time she was given to think. We leave no sophistry unturned as our rhetoric becomes more intense, using our very large vocabularies to disguise our very common sense.
40 years on. My affair with Harrison was a very long one-night stand. I was relieved when it ended. I didn't approve of myself. If he was unable to see that I had feelings for him, at least 5, but sometimes as many as 7, and he wasn't as smart as I thought he was, as I knew he was. So I loved him, and he allowed it. That's as close a reckoning as I can muster 4 decades later. I'm frequently still awkward in his presence, still struggle with what I'm going to say. I always imagine that he's thinking that I've just said something asinine, which may or may not be true. And whatever was the state of his marriage, which ended soon after the filming of Star Wars for reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with me, I don't think of Harrison in any way as a womanizer. I think he was lonely in England. We were all lonely in an upbeat beginning of our public lives way. I think. At least I was, and I'm making an educated guess about the others. None of us ever starred in a movie before, and Harrison was the only one of an age where he could muster some perspective. We were on the island of location, and location is the land of permission, where you can behave in ways that you would never behave in the real world. There was Harrison, and there was me, both 3 months away from home, on location where you were free to do what neither of you would do when surrounded by your all-too-loving family and all-too-observant friends, where everything and everyone around you was interesting and new, where you have all sorts of new people now focused on you and how you're feeling, but not in the usual quasi-claustrophobic way. These were people who didn't want anything from you except that you have your lines memorized, your costume on, and your hair and makeup smooth and neat. Especially your hair. Well, mine anyway, which tended to get unpinned and stray out of the confines it needed to stay in. Even though you were running around and shooting guns, your hair absolutely could not be in disarray. One had to look all neat and tidy while involved in the aerobic activity of saving the galaxy. For most of us, home is an environment that discourages you from fooling around of any kind. Not that any of us were necessarily inclined to act out on adulterous impulses. I look back and see us all being playfully physical with one another, enjoying that familial comfort that developed among us. Us being me and Mark, though my focus on what happened between Mark and myself diminished once things began with Mr. Ford. On some days, I would self-consciously draw back from contact with him, while on others, I would have fun frolicking through brightly lit hallways, touching an arm, ducking down my bun-encased head, or grazing a powdered forehead to his smuggler's jacket. Leaning over to look at some allegedly unremembered lines, falling into him, my smaller self to his larger one, in a fit of suppressed laughter between takes. What's that saying I've said before? And I'll keep saying it until things can finally get unsaid. Location, location, location. Kissing me in the car was the last time that Harrison would be able to labor under the relaxing assumption that I was your average, everyday, sexually experienced would-be actress, someone accustomed to drunkenly jumping into the backs of cars and later falling into bed. A brief and amazingly casual encounter with said would-be actress, looking to add to her currently very short, but, like many other humans, over the ensuing years, increasingly longer line of exciting, unclothed experiences with attractive men. For me, a brief, thrilling liaison I would eventually calmly walk away from, smiling and sophisticated, anticipating the looks on my friends' faces when I could safely and cavalierly recount that amusing tryst I'd had on this cool little sci-fi film I'd done in England. I would laugh ironically as I told my fascinated, impressed pals about this man whom I had been attracted to. How could I not be? He was so handsome. I was barely old enough to vote, but I could easily enlist in the army, and I enlisted into the army of him. But we'd both known from the start this wouldn't be a love affair. Just two adult humans who hadn't fallen in love with each other but appreciated each other. We were both adults. Why shouldn't we have a little fun together? It never occurred to me to feel hurt because he hadn't fallen in love with me. It was better this way. Friendly feelings and wonderful sex. What a nice change it had been from my relationship with Simon in drama school. So emotional, so innocent and new. No mess, no fuss. There was him and there was me. None of your needy couple shit, right? And I was now 5'6" tall, had green eyes, was slender, lithe, and free of self-pity all the time. Right. Sure. But you've got to feel bad for Harrison. Well, you don't have to, but if you can, for my sake, try. Not bad as in actually feeling a pang of anything emotional. Give me a break. No, I mean, just the sort of bad you might feel when someone is telling you a longish story about how they were talking about the surprise gift they bought for someone. And then that someone overheard the conversation and the surprise was ruined. Oh, no, how awful. What did you do? A ruined surprise kind of awful, as opposed to, is that guy JD still living with you? Huh, 'cause I was just at the drugstore and saw him picking up some medication, and I overheard him telling the pharmacist it was for his leprosy. I mean, there's bummer bad, and then there's, oh my fucking shitbag, no way, you're kidding, right? Sort of bad. Blithely sympathetic bad or end of the world bad. There, see? And all I was trying to do was say that I feel a little bad for Harrison at this point in my life, which he would loathe, so I take it back. But when it was happening, I didn't feel bad for him. I only felt bad, and more than a little, for myself. Time shifts, and your pity enables you to turn what was once, decades ago, an ordinary sort of pain or hurt, complicated by embarrassing self-pity, into what is now only a humiliating tale that you can share with others because, after almost four decades, it's all in the past and who gives a shit. As I mentioned, a few times already, perhaps, en route between Elstree Studios and London, between Boreham Wood and London, between Surprise Party and the next thing, Harrison and I spent quite a lot of time kissing. Later, Harrison informed me what a bad kisser I actually was then. Not that he knows what kind of a kisser I am now. In the car then. The remark probably stung a bit, even 6,000 years after the event, but I wonder about it now. I wish I could return to Harrison, maybe while he was recuperating from some airplane accident or being crushed by a flying piece of film set. He would be lying in bed, a leg or two elevated, his brow smoothed with forced serenity. "Why do you think I was such a bad kisser?" I would ask casually. He would look out the window at the failing lights, chewing the inside of his cheek quietly. "Maybe," I'd suddenly offer, "it was because I was so shocked to find myself on the receiving end of an off-screen kiss from some person I'd have an on-screen kiss with in a movie or two that my mouth just sort of hung open in amazement." "Oh, shut up," he'd growl without looking at me. I always have him shut me up in our imagined interactions, probably because he always looks like he wants me to lose my grip on the English language anyway. I suppose in part I'm telling this story now because I want all of you, and I do mean all, to know that I wasn't always some overweight woman without an upper lip to her name, who can occasionally be found sleeping behind her face and always thinking in her mouth. I was once a relevant piece of ass who barely knew she existed, while much of the rest of the movie-going world saw me romping through the air in a metal bikini, awake as I needed to be in order to slay space slugs, being whoever I needed to be in the face of affective disorders and otherwise. I can now share this story with others because it's part of history. It's so long ago, it winds up being a real workout for my memory. This is an episode that's only potentially interesting because its players became famous for the roles they were playing when they met. Harrison is a decent, albeit complicated and frequently silent guy. He's always been decent to me, and as far as I know, the only time he cheated on any one of his three wives was with me. And maybe he didn't think that counted all that much because of how short I am. So, while there's still time for Harrison to grow old together, that gateway is steadily closing. If we're going to get back together, we're going to have to do it soon. And getting back together with someone you were never truly with is, to say the least, complicated. But absolutely worth the effort. Or not. My hopes aren't high, and neither, as it happens, am I. I'll probably regret writing this at various intervals, so if you have the impulse to yell at me about it, please don't, because no, I already feel guilty. Luminous beings were we. In the beginning, when Star Wars became a bona fide phenomenon, none of us knew how to be famous. Well, maybe Harrison or Mark did, but if so, they weren't sharing their insights with me. They didn't offer that class at Berlitz, and we lacked a manual containing suggestions on how to edge into this transitional state smoothly. Yes, I know, I should have been able to access what was expected of me by watching my mother and elusive part-time father, which I would have done had I anticipated a life like theirs, which was, in fact, lifelike. But remember, I knew I would never go into such a fickle business. It all happened so quickly. Instantly, there was a lot of fan mail, and we initially read all of it ourselves. As I've said, I had known celebrity before in connection with the tabloid frenzy surrounding my parents, so I wasn't exactly swimming in unfamiliar waters. But having watched their fame diminish over the course of their lifetimes had taught me the limit of fame. You could clutch the tail of this wild tiger, but you had to know, or at least I knew, that at some point it would wrest itself from your desperate grasp and hightail it off to someone else's jungle. Besides, this Star Wars fame meant that Princess Leia was famous, and not really Carrie Fisher. I just happened to look like her, minus her bad hair, and plus less conspicuous bad hair, all my own. I think fame might be more fun when it's personal and not just someone remarking how trippy it is that you look so much like that Star Wars character. It's still fun, though. Don't get me wrong. Well, or do. I can't stop you. I'd always had what I referred to as associative fame. Byproduct fame. Fame as the salad to some other slightly more filling main dish. Celebrity daughter fame, and later, when married to Paul Simon, celebrity wife fame. And now with Star Wars, I had that happen to have played an iconic character fame. Still, being newly famous in whatever way you were famous was a very busy business. The main task at hand was showing people that I was just as independent and likable as was the intergalactic princess I portrayed. I think boys may have been attracted to my accessibility. Even if I did have some princessy qualities, I wasn't conventionally beautiful and sexy, and as such, was less likely to put them down or think I was too good for them. I wouldn't humiliate them in any way. I mean, even if I teased them in the context of running around with laser guns dodging bullets, I wouldn't do it in a way that would hurt them. What is happening? How did we get here? Where is here? How long will it last? What is it? Do I deserve it? What does this make me? What do you wear to an event like that? What do you think I should say? What if I don't know the answer? Being around my mom when she was being recognized was hardly an effective preparation for any of this. Fame can be incredibly intense, and of course none of us had any idea anything like it would ever happen. You'd have to be a psychic of a very unique Hollywood sort to guess something of this order was up ahead, ready to ambush you, transforming the character you played into a household name. The studio would set up a tour, a press junket, which was what you did, especially for a movie like this, where the cast were virtual unknowns. Then the movie came out, and everyone went wild. Suddenly, this little movie needed no promotion. But because no one could ever have anticipated that, we ended up doing the junket anyway, which became the definition of overkill. But whatever it was, it turned out that wherever we went, people were waiting, and they all seemed very happy to have us there, selling the sold. We'd done this little low-budget film. They'd even flown us economy to our location in London to save money. And we lived off a per diem that came nowhere near the vicinity of luxurious. We'd done a cool little off-radar movie directed by a bearded guy from Modesto. A thing like that wasn't going to make people want to play with a doll of you, was it? It was one movie. It wasn't supposed to do what it did. Nothing was supposed to do that. Nothing ever had. Movies were meant to stay on the screen, flat and large and colorful, gathering you up into the sweep of story, carrying you rollicking along to the end, then releasing you back into your life. But this movie misbehaved. It leaked out of the theater, poured off the screen, affected a lot of people so deeply that they required endless talismans and artifacts to stay connected to it. Had I known it was going to make that loud of a noise, I would have dressed better for those talk shows and definitely would have argued against that insane hair. Although the hair was, in its own modest way, a big part of that noise. And I certainly wouldn't have ever just blithely signed away any and all merchandising rights relating to my image and otherwise. And on top of whatever else, Mark, Harrison, and I were the only people who were having this experience. So who did you talk to that might understand? Not that this is some sort of tragedy. It just puts you in an underpopulated, empathy-free zone. I mean, obviously, I'd never starred in a movie, but this was completely not like starring in your average, everyday movie. It was like being one of the Beatles. Maybe. Sure, most of it was a fun surprise, but the days where you could really let your guard down were over because now there were cameras everywhere. I had to comport myself with something approaching dignity at 20. But when we first began getting fan mail 40 years ago, it was complicated to know what to do. Do you answer every letter or ignore some of the less enthusiastic? So for the first few months, we all, that's all, Harrison, Mark, and myself, answered every letter. How I know this is because we all received a letter from the mother of a little girl who was going blind and who had seen Star Wars with her last sight, and would we send her daughter an autographed picture of ourselves before she went blind altogether? So the three of us promptly hurried off and sent her the letter before she lost her sight, and somehow we all ended up discovering that little Lisa was a 20/20 sighted woman of 63, causing us one of many laughs in our giddy days of early fame. None of us had done talk shows before, so we were forced to develop not only our public personas, but our talk show styles as we went from one to the next, touting the film that needed no tout. A tout-free experience, we should have informed the hosts before lining up like tin ducks at a carnival waiting to be shot. And shot we were by televised film cameras all over the U.S. and eventually onward overseas. I noticed right away that Harrison tended to quote philosophers when describing what he thought of the film. As Winston Churchill said, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts," he might have said when asked if he thought success would change us. He also might have said, "Give me a minute. I've only been successful for a few weeks." He might have said these things, but I'm pretty sure he didn't. But whatever he said shamed me. Why wasn't I quoting philosophers? Because I dropped out of high school midway through the 11th grade. Well, when you really came right down to it, not similar to down to Earth or Earthlings, being a dropout was a good reason to tune in and turn on. But it was no excuse for not quoting philosophers on daytime talk shows. Mike Douglas loves philosophers. People on the dating game misquoted the greatest minds of all time. "The unintentional life is not worth believing," Harrison might have said, and still gotten chosen as bachelor number 3. After a few shows of listening to Harrison waxing philosophical, I decided to take action. Harrison had majored in philosophy in college. What could I do to remain undaunted? Then it came to me. I would consult with a college professor in philosophy. And not just any college. I called Sarah Lawrence in suburban New York and asked if there was a professor whom I could consult with. They seemed hesitant until I mentioned Star Wars and implied I might soon share the screen with an intergalactic great mind known as Yoda, who would, of course, intone, "Do or do not. There is no try." As far as doing went, that seemed to do the trick. Not that the higher-ups at Sarah Lawrence are susceptible to Star Wars any more than the average or above-average human, which is to say that they were more flexible regarding the possibility of securing a professor for insecure me. Having had a few tutorials in philosophy, I believe I found one or two talk shows where I could employ my new college-level insights, but quickly determined that to have two actors spouting philosophical gems to the movie-going public was a bit much. A bit of smuggler monkey see, princess monkey do. So, after a very short while, I gave up on looking intelligent, thank God, and I continue that to this day. I would make it look like a devious plan when I seemed less than effervescent and approaching pedestrian without a crosswalk. You couldn't accuse me of doing a less than stellar job on the Johnny Carson show without my insisting that you had forgotten my telling you that that had been my intention all along. We did so many chat shows that we finally wound up being overexposed. There are worse tragedies, but you couldn't have gotten me to guess what they were at the time. But we plodded along, newly minted celebrities, gracing television shows all over America. We didn't realize initially how big a hit the movie was because we were traveling to every capital in every state promoting it, which you do when a film is an unknown quantity. It was being on the run and feeling as though I was trying to either keep up with something or keep away from some danger at my heels. But then bodies in motion tend to stay in motion, so that's where we stayed, in motion and on the road. To relax in our giddy, unrelaxed configurations, we would sometimes go to amusement parks. I remember one particular day in Seattle where Harrison, well, all of us really, had gotten on a Ferris wheel that had cages for seats that tended to spin as it went around. As you can see, it's difficult to describe. But the bottom upside-down line is that Mark and I had gotten on the ride first, so when we got off, we watched as Harrison, who, like all of us, was still wearing what we'd worn on TV, not your optimum style for Disneyland light, got on. And Mark and I stood on the ground laughing while a poker-faced Harrison hung upside down like a dressed-up fruit bat with a tie casually draped over his very serious face. In some ways, this whirling around made us look and feel like our lives looked and felt like. I don't know. You had to be there. There being everywhere all at once. The traveling snake oil salesman of space travel show business. "Hurry, hurry, hurry! Step right up, everybody, and see this new once-in-a-lifetime product I call the Star Wars, a tale of intergalactic excitement, with battle sequences and heroes and smugglers and princesses all careening through space having the time of their lives. And now you can have the time of your life For the low, low price of $5, you too will have the time of your movie going, gone life. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Act now, because this deal will only be offered. And on we went, from state to state, capital to capital, audience to audience, hawking our wares, and frequently not knowing where we were. For me, the worst part of this better-than-best time period was when I was being photographed. I hate having my picture taken. Maybe because it was already happening at the age of 6 hours, well before I was old enough to articulate my objections with words, I was forced to protest with infant expressions and baby poison eye darts. I hated it all through my childhood, when it shouldn't have been that big of a trial because I was young and cute. Even really cute, depending on who you talk to. And I loathe it now. Especially in this smartphone era, when anyone at any moment can take a candid shot somewhere when you're far from camera ready, i.e. most of the time. And you know, it's not just a bad picture, but a scornful reminder of just how old you're getting and how fat you've gotten. Not only a reminder of what you once were, but also of what you no longer are and never will be again. And, as if that wasn't enough, some stranger owns this horrific image and is free to do whatever with it, in private or with his friends. The movie had been out for a few weeks, and the lines were twisting around the blocks. The term blockbuster, in fact, was born because ticket lines would come to the edge of the street, pause for that asphalt interruption, and then begin again enthusiastically on the next block. I would drive by with my friends in disbelief, wondering how anything that popular could include me. One day, we were driving down Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood, where the Avco Cinema had what looked to me like the longest line I had seen so far. As you can imagine, I was really excited. Chuffed is the British word for it, I think. I love how they made themselves this little word that means giddy with excitement that you're trying to suppress because you'd rather be thought of as looking kind of cool. So, I stood up on the car seat, not just stuck out my head, but squeezed half my body through the sunroof and shouted, "Hey, I'm in that! I'm the princess!" Well, this certainly caused some interest, ranging from the scornful, "What an asshole," variety, to the breathless, "Do you really think it's her?" "I'm in that," I repeated for those who hadn't heard me the first time. Then, suddenly realizing what I had done, and quickly fearing that some of these moviegoers might identify me, I slid back down into my seat and said to my friend, "Quick, drive!" So she stepped on the gas and sped away. The one question people can never seem to stop asking me is, did you know Star Wars was going to be that big of a hit? Well, given that there had never actually been a film that had been that big of a hit before, who could possibly ever have assumed that there now would be? Now I've begun answering that question differently than replying, "No, I didn't know." I've begun saying, "Well, actually, I thought it was going to be an even bigger phenomenon." So, you can imagine when it wasn't, when Star Wars and its sequels failed to meet my remarkable, almost unbelievable expectations. Well, I want you to just try to imagine how crushed, how disappointed I felt, and, of course, still feel. Imagine how it felt when my anticipated dreams and fantasies failed to come true. What would you have done if you were me? Turn to drugs, maybe? Lose your mind? Possibly even both? Leia's lap dance. Could you make it to Jerry? He couldn't come today. He's having chemo. But he's been your biggest fan since he was knee-high. We showed him the movies when he was 3. Jerry. With a J. Yes, that's right. Oh, and could you write, May the Force be with you? You have no idea what this would mean to him. When I told him you were going to be here, he cried.